Good evening. We are back in session. This is the Committee on Health and Human Services. We are reconvened. This is Wednesday, March 25th, and our first bill is with Senator Hoffman, Senate File 628.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for hearing Senate File 628, which establishes an intensive pediatric care category for home care nursing services. Since this is the bill's first stop, I would like to move an author's amendment. The A1 amendment is in front of you, and basically it deletes the effective date on page 2, line 12, and if Mr. Moynihan needs to, he can walk us through the impact if the committee wishes. If not, I'd just like to move that.
All those in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, say nay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also have a brief oral amendment, and I would ask Mr. Moynihan to walk us through that. It is a simple language correction amendment, with that, Mr. Moynihan. If you have it. If not, I have it here, Mr. Moynihan.
Madam Chair, Senator Hoffman, I haven't seen the oral amendment.
Oh. Time to... That's fine.
Is it
fine.
A long oral amendment?
I can add it. I have it right here. I apologize, Mr. Moynihan. Something's out of control. So on line 2.18, after use, we're going to insert 25. So it would be numerical 25. And then go down to 2.19. You're going to take out the period after staff. You're going to insert the words and 75% of the additional revenue to pay for nursing staff pay and benefits.
Okay, so I'm just going to repeat that just to be sure. On line 2.18, we fill in the blank after use with the number 25. And on line 2.19, we eliminate the period and add the following language, and 75% of the added revenue to pay for nursing staff pay and benefits.
Madam Chair, that is correct. And that clarifies over in the House, there was a question on how much of this what percentage of that is going to go toward training, and there was really a need and a desire to see that be 25%. And Ms. Wingert is shaking her head, yes, I did understand that correctly. So that's the oral amendment in front of you.
Any further discussion, Senator Benson?
Madam Chair, Senator Hoffman, how did we arrive at 25? I mean, we used to mandate that 2% of education teachers' budget, you were on a school board, was mandated to go to training. I don't want to be stuck at 25 in statute. So how did we get to the 25? And
Senator Hoffman,
Madam Chair, and Senator Benson, that's a great question. I'm actually going to let Ms. Susan Wingert, who is the CEO of Pediatric Home Services, add that for you.
Madam Chairman,
Ms. Wingert,
Benson, committee members. We wanted to encumber this increase entirely so that it went to either training of the nurses or to their salary and benefits. What we determined in investigating this was that our contention is we need some retention here, and what was the thing that helped retain nurses was an increase in salary. So we wanted the majority of it going directly to them and then to the agency to ensure that the nurses were properly trained. We are open to any suggestion on whether there is a better number there or a better way of phrasing that.
While Senator Benson's discussing it, do you want to move through the bill?
I will, Madam Chair. Thank you. With me today is Rebecca Wergler, who is a patient mother. We're all patient parents, by the way. Dr. Roy Maynard, who is a pediatric pulmonologist, and then, of course, you just heard from Susan Wingert, who's the CEO of Pediatric Home Services. And I'll just go on a 10,000-foot viewpoint. Senate File 628 would establish a new reimbursement tier for home care nursing provided by highly skilled and specialized nurses. These are for high acuity, medically complex children who are in their homes. A new intensive pediatric home care nursing tier is necessary because of the dramatic advancements in medical technology and the education of nurses using advanced care therapies in home, hence pediatric home services. Mm-hmm. Furthermore, current reimbursement rates that are there do not allow providers to be competitive payment with hospitals. That creates a never-ending staffing crisis for the home care nursing agencies and the families. And you will hear the story from Rebecca Wergler regarding that, the agencies, the families, and to those pediatric patients. So this bill seeks to pay nurses for what they do, not where they do it. Passing Senate File 628 would solve the problems for families, patients, and nurses who care for them. So I'm going to turn this presentation over to the testifiers, and thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. So Dr. Roy Maynard, are you the next presenter, or am I out of order here?
Madam Chair, I'm the person that's going to introduce the bill.
Okay, Ms. Wingert.
thank you, everyone. My name is Susan Wingert. As Senator Hoffman has indicated, I own a company called Pediatric Home Service. We take care of medically fragile, technology-dependent children in the home. I know this has been a long day for you, and I'm not going to waste a lot of time trying to explain what I do, but to tell you that we have an ever-increasing problem with maintaining high-quality nurses to take care of patients that on Monday are in an intensive care unit and on Tuesday are in their home. One of the things that we have determined is a problem for us is the ability to retain them based on things such as simply as how we can pay them. The amount of money that we are allowed on the highest level of reimbursement from the state of Minnesota is inadequate to maintain them. And so what we are asking for is a third level, a level that speaks to the high skill and critical thinking needs that the nurses that take care of these patients in the home must have. We oftentimes mention that these nurses are different than the ones in the hospital, because in the hospital, when you have a crisis, you turn around, you hit a button, and the cavalry comes. When you're in the home, you, the nurse, are the cavalry. And so on that note, I'd like to turn it over to Becca Wergler, who is going to give you some personal experience on what it's like to have a medically fragile, technology-dependent child in the home and the concerns and fears she has when inadequately trained people are there to minister to her child.
Thank you. Welcome, Ms. Wergler. Please begin your testimony after you introduce yourself in the microphone.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate it. My name is Rebecca Wergler. Feel free to call me Becca, though. As if you open up your pamphlet, you will see a photo or a page of my daughter, Claire Wergler. She's pretty cute, if you ask me. But she is 3 years old, and she is her main diagnosis is spina bifida. She's had many complex issues because of spina bifida. She requires a tracheostomy because her vocal cords are paralyzed. And she also has central apnea, which means at night she needs to be on a ventilator so her body doesn't forget to breathe. We have had her home for 3 years. She's had 10 surgeries in her short 3 years of life. And I can tell you the nurses that we have in our home are vital to what my husband and I do every day. My husband and I both work full-time. And we cannot do our jobs unless we have those nurses. And we had the pleasure of having Senator Benson come to our home last summer and meet us and Claire and see that in our home, in our living room, is we have an intensive care unit for Claire. And you can't just put any nurse in there. That nurse has to have the training to be able to know what a ventilator alarm is, to know how to respond, to see those issues if Claire stops breathing and know what to do at that point. There is no one she can call if Claire stops breathing. She has to immediately get into action and resuscitate her. And that is a huge job, and they should be trained properly. It's interesting because when we go to the hospital for surgery or whatever, I often think everything is so specialized. There's a respiratory therapist who turns on the vent, who hooks Claire up to the vent. There's a nurse who does meds. There's all these different things. At home, there is just one nurse doing everything. And she can be at home alone or if a parent is there. But essentially, there's no one else there. There's no respiratory therapist. There's no doctor. There's no one coming in 5 seconds to help them out if that child stops breathing. So for us, if we have a shift that is open, because there's not enough nurses in the pool that are trained to work with Claire. We stay up at night. Claire can never be unattended without myself, my husband, or the nurses that are properly trained, which means we get 2 to 3 hours of sleep, and we go to work the next day, and we do it all over every single day. So those nurses are vital for us to be productive members and to continue to work.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Mm-hmm. Thank
you. And for sharing this story and this wonderful story with us and about the struggle and what you need. I appreciate that. Now is it Dr. Roy Maynard's chance to address. Please say your name and speak to us.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Dr. Roy Maynard. I am the medical director for Pediatric Home Service, but I'm also a practicing lung doctor in the state of Minnesota for children. I am also an executive committee member of the American Academy of Pediatrics Committee on Home Care and have been intimately involved in the care of medically complex children for 3 decades. I think it's very important people understand that in the past 10 years, the number of children living with medical complexities in our communities has doubled. That's across the nation. In addition, there's a subset of those patients that really do require intensive care unit level of care in the home. Without highly skilled nurses with expanded levels of competencies, those children can be placed at risk for increased morbidities, mortalities, and costly hospital readmissions. The nurses that we need to retain are very important because they require critical decision making and they require consistency in care for those children. These nurses have the same challenges and responsibilities as their hospital-based intensive care unit counterparts, but without a hospitalist outside the door or an intensivist down at the other end of the hallway. Without keeping these nurses in our home care system providing for these kids, it places the entire system in jeopardy, and I can assure you it is backlogging the discharge of medically complex children from our hospitals in this state, and it is costing millions of dollars.
Thank you, Dr. Maynard, may I ask you, you said that the number of children who are needing very specialized services, highly complex care, has doubled in a certain period of time?
Yes, the number of children with medical complexity, and there's different definitions for that in the state, but the medical literature that's just come out in the past few years has shown that across the nation, it's doubled. And the reason is we have technologies now that didn't exist 30 years ago when I was an intern. I used to walk into a room and say, we're really sorry, we can't help you, there's nothing to treat this disease, take your child home and they're going to die. Now we can support those children, they can live at home for a much less cost than being hospitalized. We don't necessarily cure all of them, but we can promote a good quality of life and they can be with their families in a safe environment.
Thank you. Are there other questions for our testifiers?
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Hoffman, how many other services are there like this pediatric home service in the state? Is this just one that serves just the metro, or is there other services around the state?
There are, Madam Chair.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Rosen, I'm going to let Susan get you the exact number. I know a handful off the top of my head.
But. Ms. Winger?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there are a number of other agencies that care for medically fragile children in the home. They're in excess of about 45. Pediatric Home Service happens to be a unique agency as we are the only pediatric exclusive company that does that. We also provide medical equipment and infusion therapy, so we're kind of a little different package than the rest.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Winger, is there any other specialized training that the nurses have to go through, or are they all, is it more of a kind of a personality, you hire by personality, or do they have to go through more thorough education and training?
Ms. Winger.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Rosen, RNs are trained to a certain level. What we do in our organization is we bring them a different level of understanding. As Mrs. Wergler mentioned earlier, in the hospital, nurses are in a more specialized role. You need to have somebody work with a ventilator. A respiratory care practitioner comes in to do that. In the home, they are the practitioner. So part of the training that PHS does for them is to teach them how to use pieces of equipment. There's an infusion nurse and component in the hospital that takes care of lines and things of that nature. In the home, again, it's the nurse that does that. And so their training is expanded to those levels of service. Then for us, when they go into certain homes, there may be diagnoses that have certain things associated with them. A child may have a neurological problem or metabolic problem or pulmonary problem or cardiac problem or combination of those. And so the familiarity with that child and the specific needs of that child are part of the training. It's extremely important. It is mandatory.
Ms. Winger, that's what you're talking about for the 25%, that you're using the resources to specialize the and expand the expertise of the nurse for that particular patient in that particular situation.
Yes, we do that now, but at a loss, we're asking for some compensation for that.
But there's not a certification or a licensing process that goes along with this, which may be something we'll have to look at in the future, huh?
We would, Madam Chair, very much like to see our nursing schools specialize in this, and we're working on that from a different perspective.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Hoffman.
Well, you know, it's Senator Eaton and Senator Wicklund actually toured. We all three toured it last year, and Senator Eaton with her nurse's hat got to interact with the nurses that were there and see the durable medical slide and saw some kiddos. There were a lot of young kids. Of course, it was Halloween,
I was going to say, wasn't it?
So. Thank you. I think there are not, we have the oral amendment that we need to consider. Is there any further discussion on the oral amendment? Do you need to have it not at all. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The oral amendment passes. I think we're ready for a motion, Senator, but I just wanted to say that I really appreciate the unique nature of this kind of nursing practice. When I was first in clinical practice, I worked in a hospital that had all of the resources. It's not that the underlying training did not teach me how to do much of what you're describing, but when you get into clinical practice, especially in a large institution, they have specialty services, starting IVs, starting, you know, dealing with ventilators, and you lose the practice of the skill. So I worked at the University of Minnesota when it was my first big practice out of school, and then went to St. Peter's Community Hospital and went from a very specialized unit that did just one thing to just a community-based. I was in pediatrics in one room. I was in an infectious disease in the next room and had to go into the ER and draw blood for blood alcohol level or something like that. And I tell you, it's a really, really demanding kind of clinical practice, and that's what you're really talking about. At least it's narrowed down to a specific patient, and you can get good at it in that particular environment. So,
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Benson.
I don't mean to step on your story, which was exactly how we needed to look at this, but visiting with Claire, the nurse also sat right on the floor and played Polly Pockets and helped Claire to put away her Polly Pockets when she was done. There's just this other stuff that goes along with this level of nursing, this kind of nursing.
All righty. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Thank you very much, Senator Hoffman. The bill passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Pass to go
let
to
me
finance.
Make sure. It's got to, well, just make sure we've got the right amendment. I'm sorry. Your motion is the bill be passed as amended and be referred to finance.
That is correct, Madam Chair.
I'm sure that's what you said, but
absolutely.
We'll vote on it again.
You are reading my mind telepathically on that.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay.
Thank you very much.
All right. Now we have, oh, my goodness, Senator Rosen, the trifecta.
They're highly controversial bills.
Yes.
As you can tell.
We'll begin with 883, Senator Rosen's social worker inactive status license modifications.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. Senate File 883 is a legislative proposal from the Board of Social Work. I do have the A1 amendment that I'd like to move.
Madam Chair?
Senator Rosen offers the A1 amendments in our packet. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay.
Madam
it's
Chair,
a, it's
just
simply repealer language, correct?
Right. It's just a technical amendment, not there's no substantive. It's just basically the House research, realign some things and put them into a different section. But first of all, I would like to thank the board for bringing this proposal forward. And we did actually hear this. This is in the governor's budget for going forward. And we heard it in HHS Finance probably a couple of months ago. And it's a non-controversial proposal. It responds to the mental health workforce shortage by creating a license option for retired social workers. It creates a better balance with enforcement for violations by creating an administrative non-disciplinary late fee. It reduces legal expenditures and creates greater efficiencies and expedites the response time. And it creates two new fees to support the policies, which are included in the governor's budget for 16-17. And there's $3,000 of additional revenue. With me, I do have Cade Sacrapate, the executive director of the Minnesota Board of Social Work.
Thank you. Welcome, Ms. Sacrapate. Would you please say your name into the microphone and begin your testimony?
Certainly. My name is Cade Sacrapate. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Board of Social Work. And Madam Chair and members of the committee, I first want to thank you for the opportunity to present the board's policy bill, Senate File 883. We believe that this is a really practical, innovative, and responsive bill to the needs of Minnesotans. Thanks to Senator Rosen and all the other senators who did sign on to support this bill. And I might also mention that the companion bill, which is House File 960, passed unanimously in the House on March 4th. So that was also good news for the board. Just very briefly, the board's core public safety mission is to ensure that licensed social workers are qualified, ethical, and accountable, and that they adhere to professional standards of practice. We investigate and resolve alleged complaints. We educate social workers and citizens about the board and licensing responsibilities. The board currently licenses over 13,800 social workers who meet standards at four different license types, which are both at the bachelor's and master's degree level. And as you are aware, the board is entirely fee supported. We receive no general fund dollars. So Senator Rosen did a great job, I think, of highlighting the benefits of this bill, the rationale for these policy proposals, and really why I think these innovative, practical reforms are needed now in 2015. So again, I would just, you know, really reemphasize these proposals are non-controversial. They are well supported by the professional associations. These proposals will have positive impact for the citizens of Minnesota, for the board, and for licensees. And what I would like to do, and again, I will try to be brief, is just to walk you through the bill just a little bit so that you are clear on the policy provisions. Section 1 contains that change to the current inactive licenses that Senator Rosen highlighted with the creation of a new emeritus active license. And again, you know, the real rationale here is to try to respond more effectively to the mental health workforce shortages in Minnesota by creating what we believe, and we have heard from a number of stakeholder groups and other legislators, that this really is an innovative licensing option that we will hopefully be able to utilize retired social workers before they sort of phase out their contributions to the workforce. And this license would enable retired social workers to do pro bono or volunteer social work practice and to engage in paid social work practice for the purpose of providing licensing supervision, you know, which we have heard from a number of stakeholders really has been a challenge because there are a shortage in qualified eligible supervisors. I would also just really, stress, I think another important thing is that this particular new license, the Emeritive Active License, has actually been identified as a recommendation in the 2015 Minnesota Mental Health Workforce Development Plan that has really been spearheaded by Senator Claussen. And again, you know, the idea is to increase mental health workforce, you know, in which licensed social workers really play a very key role. This license is renewable, which also provides the board a mechanism to maintain standards and oversight. Section 2 and 3 amends our current reactivation section and really contains only the necessary technical changes to ensure that the cross references are accurate, given that we are making changes in other portions of this bill. Section 4 and 5, as Senator Rosen mentioned, amends the board's fee section by first creating a new Emeritus Active License fee, which is necessary in order for us to implement the new Emeritus Active License, which is the policy provision included in Section 1 of the bill. And as an incentive, the fee that has been set for this new license is very intentionally set at a 50% reduced rate from the board's active licensing fees. Section 5 creates the new license late fee that Senator Rosen mentioned. Again, that can be utilized as an administrative fee used as a non-disciplinary option to resolve some unlicensed practice cases. And again, the real idea there is for the board to be able to better balance enforcement with some unlicensed practice violations, so it really gives the board an additional important tool. And I would just say, lastly, just very briefly about Section 6, which is the current temporary license provision. And in this bill, what we are really hoping that you will support is the repeal to Subdivision 12, which is the automatic ineligibility provision in the current temporary license. And let me explain why this is important. Under current law, this automatic ineligibility requirement causes the board to automatically deny a temporary license even when an applicant meets all standards of education, examination, and background checks if the applicant has already started employment as a social worker. And so we have just recognized that that really does create an unintended consequence, and it makes it so much more difficult for those individuals to become part of the workforce. So the request of you is to support this and repeal this particular subdivision, which again will eliminate that unintended consequence, and it removes that barrier to obtaining a temporary license for qualified applicants. It will allow the board to issue and expedite those licenses to applicants who, again, I just really want to assure you, meet standards. And with this, we will be able to provide consumers additional access to qualified licensed social workers, including new graduates, members of the military, their families, and professionals relocating to Minnesota. So with that, I would just conclude by thanking you very much for the opportunity to present the board's bill. And we really hope that this committee can support Senate File 883. And I would be happy to take any questions that you might have.
Are there any questions?
Thanks for your consideration.
Are there any questions from the members of the committee? I just would have one question. Is there any other board that has created this emeritus and active license?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, the only board that I am aware of who has something similar for retired licensed professionals is the Board of Psychology.
And if you could say in just one or two sentences what can they do? Not what they can't do, but what can they do with this license?
Yes, Madam Chair and members of the committee. If someone were to obtain this new license through the Board of Social Work, what they can do, which they could not do with a regular the current honorary emeritus license, what they are able to do is to engage in pro bono or volunteer practice and to also serve as licensing supervisors for which they are able to receive payment.
And they are under the supervision of the board and
That's
held
correct.
The same ethical standards and have to meet continuing education requirements as any licensed social worker would.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, yes.
Right.
Madam
Chair. I have to talk to the Board of Nursing about this.
Exactly.
I want one of them licenses.
I think there is a opportunity when you start thinking about that, especially in this line of work where people, the level of burnout rate, and perhaps mm-hmm. take a break and want to come back in. So I think it's a very out-of-the-box type of thinking. I think it I love the bill because it's was very creative, and with that, there's no further questions.
Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you. Sorry. Oh, it is very innovative. I'm thinking a teacher's license might do well under that as well. But my question was, Senator Rosen, what was the A1 amendment? There was a second repealer, 148E.075, subdivisions 4, 5, 6, and 7. What is the gist of that?
That was basically to the subdivisions 4, 5, 6, and 7 were struck out of the bill as introduced, and they're basically reorganized. And then these were added to the subdivision 12 of 148E.060 with the so it's just it's mainly a reorganization.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
The House didn't feel comfortable with the way that it was set up. And
Thank
so
you.
This is just to line up the bills.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just one more question. I'm trying to remember what I read. It's this emeritus license has to be applied for within 4 years from of retirement. Did I understand that correctly?
Madam Chair and members, no, that is not entirely accurate. Currently, the board has an honorary emeritus license, you know, and you can sort of receive your honorary title, you know, but what it does not do is that it does not authorize you to practice. You know, therefore, we recognize that we are losing an awful lot of very well-seasoned professionals, so hoping to bring them back in. With the new active emeritus license, an individual can apply, I would say, at any point that they are retired, and obtain this license and then continue to practice in that limited capacity.
Okay, so there's not a time limit within, since you've retired, in which you have to?
I would say no to that.
I'm just trying to check this out for personal reasons. I'm sorry to hold you up to this, but I can tell you that I wouldn't mind having this for some purposes, but with an advanced practice out of the field for 4 years would make me dangerous if I went back in, so I wouldn't want to apply it to that. Senator Hayden.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Rosen. I think that this is the very good out-of-the-box thinking, as you said. We often, I think maybe sometimes disrespectfully talk about our professionals that are retiring or I always have trouble with this, Madam Chair, when we talk about as people get older, we just kind of say, well, they're just out of the workforce. They're gone into oblivion. And that's really not the case. People are still here. They may want to change the way in which they work. They may not want to be tethered to a particular organization, or because of retirement benefits, they may want to do that differently, but they still have a lot to offer. And so I just think that this gives an opportunity for professionals, kind of in the way in which they want to do it, to be able to still provide practice with the clinical supervision, but also provide a lot of wisdom, not only for the clients, Madam Chair, that they're working with, but also younger professionals who are learning how to practice as well. And I think that the ability for them to have this kind of peer review and mentorship is probably something that is going to be very valuable as we start to move forward. So I think this is a great idea, and I'm with you, Madam Chair. I think we should be thinking about this for other professions as we start to wrestle with this issue of people starting to leave the workplace or starting to retire.
Thank you.
Thank you. Without further discussion, Senator Rosen, your actions
yes.
would be to
I move that Senate File 883 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Finance.
That's correct.
Okay.
Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Passes. Okay, we're going to move
Thank
now to Senate
much.
File 706. Senator Rosen again, foster care licensing, home and community-based service standards, and disability waiver rate system provision modifications.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm waiting for Ms. Turner. Senate File 706 is, first off, Madam Chair, I do have the A1 amendment that I'd like to move.
Senator Rosen offers the A1 amendment, which is among our materials.
And Madam Chair, this basically is to line up with some of the House language. They took out some sections. It's just easier, and I think this is what the ARM would appreciate, is to have some clarity on the bill going forward. So, and speaking of clarity, this is a clarity of our 245D. 234-5D was adopted in 2012 with revisions made in 2013 and 14 to make clarifications, corrections, changes based on the stakeholder agreement.
Senator Rosen, are you beginning to talk about the bill, the
I
purpose
am.
Of the bill? I think I'll just take action on your A1 amendment first.
Yes.
Senator Rosen offers the A1 amendment. Is there any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Passes. Thank you. Sorry, Senator Rosen, for interrupting.
No, thank you. I'm sorry, too. So this bill contains a number of technical changes that provide clarification to assist in the consistency and implementation. It also contains a revision of 245A to assure consistency with the language of 245D and a revision of 256B, which is being done in agreement with DHS. So to recap, there has been a lack of clarity with 245D terms. We're correcting the issues that were inadvertently left out and written inaccurately in the original 245D. And it changes the language so there's no conflict between 245D and 245A. And with me, I have Barb Turner, Chief Operating Officer of ARM.
Thank you, Ms. Turner. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Barb Turner with ARM. And this is a very technical bill, so I'm going to, as quickly as possible, just take you through the section so that you understand exactly what it's doing. So in Section 1, the language in this section is just changing language to match what is in 245A in regards to training that has to be done on certain kinds of equipment.
Before you go on, would you remind me, 245A is?
245A is the overall licensing rule, so everyone who is licensed under DHS at all is under that umbrella. And then 245D is a kind of a subset underneath of that.
Okay. Thank you.
So this language make sure that there's not a conflict between those two statutes. In Section 2, in this section, what we're doing is allowing programs licensed under 245D have to have program abuse prevention plans. And current language says that the governing body has to review and revise those annually. Oftentimes, the governing body is far removed from the actual program site, and so we're allowing delegation of that review and revision to be done by the governing body to someone who's closer to the actual program. The section...
are we on this one?
Oh, no. All right. Section 4, there's the term working day is used throughout 245D, and so we're just clarifying what working day is since group homes, people work every day, but in working day, we're meaning a normal Monday through Friday business day. So that's what that section is doing. In the next section, we are... that's where there's an amendment. Basically, we're just trying to clarify how soon someone needs to be notified if there's a significant change in health, in the health status of an individual. In Section 7, language was changed last year so that there's a requirement that you get authorization to administer medications to someone you're providing services to. And language was changed last year to say you just needed to do that once unless there would be a change in the person's needs. But it's not clear here. So we're doing some clarification so that it's clear that that's the intention, that it's a one-time signature, and it can be, you know, changed if it's reviewed. It's reviewed on an annual basis, but doesn't need to be signed on an annual basis. In the Section 8, the words serious injury were inadvertently left out when 245D was developed, and it has always been a requirement that reports of death and serious injury be made to the Ombudsman Office, and so those words are just being added in this section. In Section 9, this is just taking out the words in person in regards to CPR instruction to allow for the instruction to be done online or via video, but the test out and the assessment piece would still need to be done in person with the CPR instructor. And Section 10, this section currently in statute, you can use a restraint to provide a medical treatment, something ordered by a medical professional, to someone for a short-term or chronic situation, but not for something that's ongoing. And so we serve a lot of people in the community who have situations where they need to be catheterized or need blood finger pricks for diabetes checks or whatever. And so we're taking out words here so that we would be able to use restraint to provide medical treatments that were prescribed by medical professionals. So the restraint isn't the treatment. The restraint is so the treatment can be completed. In Section 11, we're just clarifying the current language just said 15 days, and we put the word calendar in to clarify the intent there. In Section 12, there's two pieces here, and basically what we're doing is matching language for programs licensed under the waivers. You have 45-day meetings or 30-day meetings, and you have annual meetings. And last year, we clarified language for 45-day meetings in regards to when reports have to be sent out, and we're just matching that language up now so that annual meetings have the same requirement. And the same thing in regards to so that's a pre-report. And then the second piece is language regarding reports that get sent out after meetings. And the issue is that there's a requirement that signatures be obtained to confirm the agreement that was reached at that meeting. And oftentimes those signatures are difficult to obtain. Guardians and case managers simply don't return the form. And providers spend a lot of time trying to chase them down and actually can't implement things because they haven't gotten the approval to implement what was agreed to. So this language simply says that if we send out the report, if we don't hear back within 10 days, there's an assumption that you agreed to what we had discussed at the meeting. And we will then implement those changes unless we hear from someone in writing after that. In Section 13, this has to do with who can deem someone competent once training has been provided. And the language we're putting in here would allow either the trainer or instructor to deem competency or someone that the trainer has already deemed competent. And the example I can give you here is oftentimes training is done in groups in kind of a central location, and they'll train on teeth brushing and hair washing and cooking, and then they go out to the group homes to actually demonstrate that they know how to brush the teeth and do the hair. So the instructor wouldn't necessarily go out to all of the homes to watch it happen. So it would be someone, but the person who would be doing that would be someone who had already been deemed competent by the instructor. And in Section 14, this language simply says that if you have a current certification for first aid, oftentimes those are 2 or 3 year certifications, that you don't have to have annual training in first aid as long as your certification is current. Section 15, again, this just matches the same language. It's another section on CPR that we talked about earlier.
And I got a question, Madam Chair.
Senator Hayden.
Senator Rosen, in Section 13, could you use telemedicine for that? No, I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I'm sorry. It's getting late.
We're getting loosey-goosey here. She's a little loosey-goosey.
Inside baseball, but that was pretty good, Senator Hayden.
I like telemedicine. medicine too.
Sorry for the interruption.
Sorry,
please continue.
Section 16 is actually, when 245D was developed, in the writing of it, the department felt that they were simply doing some clarification of language that had been in 245B in regards to staffing ratios in day services. And as we reviewed the language, it was felt that hadn't happened, and so in agreement with the department, they've just done clarification to make sure it's what it used to be so that there was no change in how those ratios were established. And then the last section is section 19, and this is removing language that was actually in language in 256B having to do with rate setting. And there was language inserted 2 years ago that said there would be a monitoring technology review panel established that would review all uses of monitoring technology. That was not the intent and is not the intent of the department, and we've worked with them for a couple of years on what is actually happening, which is a review of situations where cameras are being used in bedrooms, and that was really their original intent. So their suggestion was to simply delete the language. They don't feel they need it, and so that's why that language is coming out.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? I'm hoping the department will come up and confirm on that, that this was unnecessary language. Is the department here? And we just need to have the confirmation. But are there other questions? Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Or Madam Chair, I'm sorry. I've been in committees all day. I just had a couple questions. On page 3, section 4, just the determination of working day means Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. My question is, why is that important, and does that have anything to do with overtime?
No, what it has to do with is reporting. Excuse me, Madam Chair, Senator.
Yes, excuse me. It's Ms. Zacherpate, right? It's Ms. Barb Turner. Yeah, okay, thank you very much.
Sorry. What that has to do with is in regards to reporting things or sending things out. So it doesn't have anything to do with work schedules. It has to do more with duties of when do you have to, how many days do you have to get certain work done. And most of the things that have working day as the established language have to do with things that supervisors have to do. And supervisors usually don't work on the weekends. So we're trying to make sure they have as many days as possible to get their work done.
Thank you. And I had a couple questions.
Yes.
Second one is on
Senator section, Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On section 7, and this is stating that the reauthorization does not need to be reauthorized annually for medication. And I would just think that, why is that important? Because it seems to me that we want people involved in being aware of what medical prescriptions are being taken, and are they still necessary, and are there interactions? And I'm just curious about why the department wants to strike the requirement that it be reauthorized annually.
Good question. Ms. Hamilton, do you want to answer that, or Ms. Turner?
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, the reason that authorization is simply an authorization saying the agency is given authorization to administer the medications. It doesn't have anything to do with a review of the medications, which does happen at the annual meeting. What we're trying to do is not have paperwork done simply for the sake of paperwork, which this is normally if someone has the need to need assistance with medication, that doesn't change. And if it does, then it's part of a planning process where someone says, hey, we can do this differently now. And so we're just trying to not have things. And Catherine Finlinson, who actually worked on this language and is the guardian of somebody, was in favor of this at the point that she was still involved, because there's a lot of things that just get signed and signed and signed when there's really perhaps not a need for it. So that's the rationale there.
And my last
question. Senator Nelson.
And thank you for explaining that. I'm all for getting rid of unnecessary forms. I just want to make sure we have patient or client protection still in place. And then the last one, I can't seem to find it here, but it was this idea that if it was kind of like if you don't respond, in 10 days, then we're just going to assume that you agree.
Page 12, lines 12.27,
yes.
Starting there.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank
My
you.
Same so question. Thank you, Senator Nelson.
That's concerning to me because how do you know if they got the information? How do you know that I don't know. I'm just worried about removing rights of the clients in this regard. And I don't know that I would ever assume just because I don't hear from someone that they agree. It seems like we should get actual permission or agreement before we just assume just because you haven't responded, you agree to what we sent. I think I'm just a little cautious about that.
Yes, Senator Nelson, and furthermore, that in relationship to the deleted language about a written report being sent to the person's legal representative.
Okay. This is Barb Turner. I'll speak to that. I'll try and explain it a little more clearly. There are two different things. So in the deleted language is deleted because we reworded it, and basically the initial language said that prior to an annual meeting, so everyone has to have an annual meeting, prior to that, 5 days prior, a report kind of in prep for the meeting would be sent out to the team members. What we found, our experience is that team members rarely, if ever, review that information ahead of time, and it's quite costly, and again, administrative work that we think we can use those resources to better serve people. So we want to have the opportunity to say, we'll send it to you 5 days ahead of time if that's what you want, but if you don't want that, we'll simply bring it to the meeting. So that's what this language does. It says if the service plan says they want it ahead of time, we will send it ahead of time. But rather than having that be the blanket, how it's done, we want to be able to have the option of not doing that because many people don't do anything with those reports ahead of time and prefer to just kind of get it and talk about it at the meeting. So that's what that language is doing.
And you don't do that a lot. You don't do that by email.
Pardon me?
You can't send these reports out electronically?
We can't. Well, if people have secure email, but most agencies do not have a way to share that kind of information via email because it's not a secured system.
And then to Senator Nelson's question about, is the 10 working days... according to 12.27D, you're going to submit this new plan and you're giving 10 days to respond, respond in some way, and if you don't hear anything, then you can implement it until the legal representative submits a written request to revise the coordinated service and support plan. And I think the question is that an adequate amount of time? Is that correct, Senator Nelson?
Well, I have two questions. One, is it the adequate amount of time? But I also this whole idea that just because we haven't heard from you, you agree. People move. How do you know that it wasn't sitting in a dead letter box somewhere? I just think we need a little more participation in saying, yes, we agree with this plan. Instead of just by your absence of action, we assume you agree.
So this is Barb Turner responding mm-hmm. to Senator Nelson, Madam Chair, committee members. What we're trying to accomplish here is being the flip side of this is when we don't get that signature, we can't implement changes that have been agreed to at a meeting. So the people that we send it to and that we need signatures from are people who were at the meeting or might have been on the phone, I guess. But normally the guardian and the case manager are sitting with the provider at a meeting, and there's agreement as to what's going to happen. And if there's changes to the programs, we need to get confirmation that, yep, this is what we said. We spend tremendous amounts of time trying to get those signatures from case managers and from guardians. And we don't have any license holders have no power to make them do it other than to keep asking. And so we're trying to implement something so that we can say, listen, for the good of the person, we want to be able to move forward. And if we're not getting the signatures and we've made a request to get that signature, how can we keep doing our job if there's no kind of compliance on the other side? So that's what this language is trying to do.
Senator Nelson.
Madam Chair, I understand that, but it seems to me you should have it sent by registered mail then so that you are assured that the person actually received that letter. And I,
Senator Lessen, yes. Let me follow up on what you're saying. I'm not seeing here. I think you know registered mail is one concept here, but where does it say here that you will send a report to the person, to the person's representative, and to the case manager? Where is the language that obligates you to do that, whether it's by registered mail or not?
Well, I don't, this is Barb Turner, I don't see that. That is the practice. So we certainly could add some language to say that that happens. But that is the process is the meeting's held. And in the paragraph where it says within 10 working days we'll obtain a signature to document approval of the changes, I guess that's just been the assumption that in order to get that signature we have to show them what those changes are. So that's the normal procedure.
And Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Benson.
A really good catch, because it doesn't say anywhere that the person or the person's legal representative and case manager have to be presented with anything. It says if within 10 working days the license holder must obtain dated signatures, but if they don't, they can just go ahead. So it doesn't...
You know, what we're saying, we think we need more explicit language that obligates you to send a report to the person, to their representative, or and to their case manager, and that Senator Nelson is suggesting a way of documenting that it's been received. And do you have some language that might help us with this?
Yeah, Madam
Ms. White.
Chair and members, just to clarify, is the written plan provided to these people at the progress review meeting?
Mm-hmm. This is Barb Turner. The written plan is developed at that meeting, so there's discussion, people take notes, the provider goes back and puts that into a typed report that is sent out to the team members. That's the process.
To the team.
The team members would be the people who were at the meeting, so the case manager, at a minimum it's the case manager and the legal rep if there is one, and then the provider and the person if they choose to be there.
Yeah. Ms. White.
So, Madam Chair, if it takes them 3 days to do that and then they mail it and then they have to have signatures within 10 days, that seems, I don't know. There's mm-hmm. So one thing you could do is insert on 12.23 before within the license holder. This might need some work because I think it's a void in this language. The license holder must provide the written plan to the person, the person's legal representative, and case manager by certified mail. And then later, then within 10 days of the letter being sent, then the signatures would be required.
And Madam Chair, I would
Senator Benson.
Quibble with Ms. White on certified mail.
Well,
yes, but what if they put a Citrix system in place for communicating so that they can securely send documents overall? I mean, that would be valid too. I don't want to trap us into something, so let's think about what that might look like. The other thing is generally it's considered from receipt because mm-hmm. that way if there's some delay in the send, usually postmarked is considered received by the individual, but
we'd be able to know the receipt if it was certified mail, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Ms. Turner, how do you send these reports now?
They are normally sent just via regular mail. And one of the things we're trying to do, resources are very tight for, right. for our members. So if our option is to chase after people and it would be more beneficial to provider to then strike this language if we have to go to certified mail. That's you have to get it there. You have to pay for it. Mm-hmm. What we're trying to do is really do something so we can continue to provide good services to people. And when their representatives or case managers aren't doing what they're supposed to do, we're stuck then. Someone should have a new program or be doing something differently, and we can't implement it. So that's really what we're trying to do. So I certainly understand there could be those cases where a letter gets lost or misplaced or whatever. But if the option is to go to certified mailings, then we would simply take this. Our preference then would be to not do this and continue to struggle with getting signatures.
What is the wish, Senator Nelson?
Well, Madam Chair, I would be more comfortable striking this. And I'll tell you why. I don't know about foster care. But a lot of this sounds a lot like a personal representative for someone like my father, who is in a long-term care facility with Alzheimer's. The problem is sometimes these, and I don't know if this is the case or not, and you can correct me if it's not here, but I get a sense that sometimes these bureaucratic planned reviews are such, like I get a letter in the mail that says, we're having a case manager meeting on this day at this time, and then I send back and say, well, I can't be there at this time. It has to be at another time. But you never hear back. So then you find out they have the meeting anyway. And so I'm just concerned about not keeping the legal representative involved. And maybe that's not an accurate description of what's happening here. But that's what I'm reading, and that's what I'm reading from my experience, that some of these things are keeping the legal representative out of the loop, making it easier to keep the legal representative out of the loop. I guess that's my personal concern.
So this is Barb Turner, Senator Nelson.
Ms. Turner,
the for foster care, for waivered services, there's a requirement that the meetings be held when the team can meet, and so you have to involve. You simply can't hold a meeting and make decisions without the legal rep being there or the case manager being there. So we have to schedule meetings. We send out tentative invitations ahead of time, and if that date doesn't work for people, then a new date is scheduled so that people can attend or participate. Sometimes it might be by phone if they can't actually travel to the place, but in our services, it's not that we're just happen to be having some kind of review, and if you can come, you can come. That's not how our meetings are set up normally. So what's happening here is we've had a meeting, a group of people sat around a table normally, and we've made decisions together that we agreed on, and now we're sending out to confirm that we got it right. The notes that we took are yes, this is our understanding. And like I said, the problem that we're trying to solve is being able to actually implement what those changes are so that we can continue to move people forward. And so,
Ms. Turner, let me just sequence this a little bit. Are you talking about this document, this thing that you're sending out that you're waiting for a signature on? It is a summary of what has occurred in the annual service plan review. Is that correct?
Correct.
At which a representative of the client is present.
Yes.
Okay, so we know that the client has a representative at the annual review, and then there is a summation of that is sent out.
Yes.
Correct.
And just to summarize what you think everybody's agreed to at that meeting, and that's what you're waiting for a signature back on, and that's what you're saying, we'd like to implement it a little before the signature, if we don't get it back
before
in time.
Before the support system is invalid.
Mm-hmm. Right.
To keep the support ongoing.
And so I think I can be okay with that, since it's a report that's already been engaged on with the representative of the client. But I still, and you can disagree with me on it in a minute, Senator Nelson, but I do still not see here that you have to send out a report. And it says the report must be sent at least 5 working days to the progress review meeting if requested by the team. You know, I mean, they're just, we need something in here that assures us that there is an expectation that a report, in fact, will be sent, whether by certified mail or not. I would still insist that we have something in here that absolutely is clear that that's an obligation. It's just not in here. At a minimum, we do that. I think I've become satisfied that you do have client representation in the service plan review, which is done annually. And so there's representation there in the redesign of the plan. Correct? Have I just going to affirm that I understood that correctly?
Yes.
Senator Nelson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, that's my question, too. I don't see anywhere that specifies that you have to have client representation at the meeting. Is that here? I mean, is there any place, can you have a meeting without the client representation? I don't see anywhere that says they have to be at the meeting.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. Ms. Turner, and then is that assumed to be the case, or should we be saying something more specific? We wouldn't want to go ahead with this process if there also wasn't
right.
A representative of the client at that meeting.
So, Ms. Turner.
There are other parts of 245D that cover those things. I do have a copy of it with me if we want to grab it, but there are things that talk about service planning and what the requirements are for service planning. This is just one tiny component of that of the service planning process.
I think the question, Ms. Turner, is in that other language that you're talking about, is there a requirement of you that a representative of the client be at this meeting?
Yes. Madam Chair, on I think this could be on page 12, line 6. The license holder, in coordination with the person's support team or expanded support team, must meet with the person, the person's legal representative, and the case manager and participate.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for that. So that is in place. So Senator Hayden.
So I hesitate to weigh in, but I was just thinking of the inverse. What I was hearing is that however we work out the notification, the team can't move forward with what they've agreed to today unless they get that back. So what will happen is that for whatever reason, if it doesn't come back to it, the client and the care coordination or the team has agreed to something that they can't go forward with if they don't get this this document back, versus if they don't get it, and if we want to quibble about or we want to talk about what happens or should they know, but they fundamentally have already agreed on this. They're just ensuring. So maybe there's a clause in it that they say, oh, I don't remember doing that, or I don't want to go that far because I don't exactly know how it works. But what I just hear logically is that you can't move forward with this until you get it back, and they're saying that they've already agreed on it. So we could actually be impeding the services that folks have agreed upon if the document doesn't come back whichever way we send it. And so I just always want us to think that we also, on the flip hand side, I think that the good faith of the team is to actually start with whatever they've agreed to in terms of their care or their routine or whatever you guys agreed to.
I think that we've worked this through to understand that the service plan review requires a representative there, that you're talking about sending that plan out for signature. If you don't get it within 10 days, that you can proceed until a representative withdraws that in writing. What is still missing is clarity around the requirement, assurances that you do summarize in writing and send out to the client, their representative, and their case manager a summation of what you've agreed to in that service plan review and evaluation. So I think that if we could get some language to manage that we can satisfy everybody. Where would we place that?
Madam Chair and members, one option is 12.23. After C, insert the license holder must send the coordinated service and plan addendum to the person, the person's legal representative, and the case manager by mail.
Yeah, that would be fine. We would not have a problem.
And then within 10 days. Okay, great. Ms. Hamilton.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to reiterate that we would need that within 10 working days after the meeting, that they would send that out. That's the expectation.
So the language should include that within 10 days after the service plan review and evaluation, a summation of what's the name of the plan? Of the service plan revisions, or a summary of the service plan revisions must be sent. Is that what you're saying, Ms. Hamilton?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'm just saying that the statement that Ms. White said was fine. It just needs to say within 10 working days after the meeting.
Madam Chair and members, the signatures are due 10 days after the meeting, so the timeline's...
Mm-hmm. Ms. Turner.
The report needs to be sent within 10 days, and then we were giving an additional 10 days to get the signature back. So we have 10 days to get something out to them. They have 10 days to get us the signature back. So that would be a total of 20 days after the meeting was held that signature would be obtained.
And Madam Chair, this whole paragraph is making sure that the service plan, support plan is continuous. And we just have to make sure that the clients are served.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Nelson.
So that was not my understanding from reading this text. It makes sense, that 10 days to get the report out, 10 days to get it back, maybe add a few days for mail. But it looks like maybe in line 12.27 or somewhere, you need to state that after receipt or something, there's 10 days to return it to return. Because the way it reads right now, it doesn't really say that.
It might be in the.
Right. Let's listen to the oral amendment that we're offering.
Madam Chair, a lot of this might be already in the 245.
Senator Rosen, would you listen in? It makes sure. We have an offer here for you. Okay, Ms. White.
Okay, Madam Chair and members, 12.23 after C, insert the license holder must send the coordinated service and support plan addendum to the person's legal representative and case manager by mail within 10 working days of the progress review meeting. Then on line 2.23, the existing language would read, within 10 working days of the delete progress review meeting and insert mailing of the plan, comma, the license holder must obtain dated signatures. So that gives them the 20 days that you were talking about.
Yeah, I think that's.
Are you all right with that?
Okay. Is everyone clear?
Madam Chair, I'll move that oral
that's
amendment.
An oral amendment offered by Senator Rosen. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Passes. Thank you very much. That satisfies the concerns of the committee. Senator Rosen.
Thank you. And if there's no more questions, Madam Chair, I move that Senate File 706 as amended be recommended passed and sent to the floor to finance.
To finance. On the motion, Senator Rosen's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Motion passes. Thank you.
Thanks for your work on that, Madam Chair and members. Really appreciate that. Thank you, Barb.
Thank you.
And finally, Senator Rosen, you have Senate File 1876.
Thank you, Madam Chair. 1876 is a bill for extending the Task Force for the Protection of Our Children, a task force that Senator Sharon, Madam Chair, and I sit on. And I do have the A1 amendment that I'd like to move. It's a delete all amendment.
Do we have a copy of the
amendment?
A1 amendment?
We do?
Okay. We have Senator Rosen offers the delete all amendment to Senate File 1876. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Passes. Thank you very much. To the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, and basically it's very self-explanatory. I think this delete all really does refine the work that needs to be ongoing in the Child Protection Task Force. We just voted on some of the recommendations this last Monday. I think there's close to 100 recommendations that came out of the task force. It was a very large task force, but very productive, and somewhat, we worked very hard. There was a lot of time and effort put into that. There was three subgroups, one on training, one on family assessment, and one on screening and transparency. And we would like to continue the review of those recommendations. And we'd like to expand those efforts into child welfare system and other systems like foster care, the guardian ad litem. So we are asking that the four legislative members of the task force continue to be members of that task force with the ability to appoint 8 legislators as ex officio members of the task force. We would use our own resources to continue on and collaborating with Department of Human Services, the counties, the tribes, to implement the laws and get ready for these recommendations that need to be introduced next year. We would have the task force shall convene upon enactment of this act and continue until the last day of the 2016 legislative session. So basically, we're just trying to continue on with the work that we've started. It's Representative Ron Krisha and Representative Joel Mullery, Senator Sharon, and myself, and with the ability to expand that and bring on appointments or people from the Department of Human Services and any other folks from some of the tribes and other communities that need to be involved in that. So with that, it's very simple. This bill's already passed the House. It's sent to the floor. and looking forward to continuing our work in the Child Protection Task Force.
Thank you, Senator Rosen. Is there any discussion or questions from members of the committee? Senator Nino?
Thank you. Senator Rosen, if the report is due on February 1st, could you walk through the logic of maintaining the task force through the remaining part of the session, assuming it goes past February 1st?
Ms. Senator Rosen. Madam Chair and Senator Nino, that's a report. It doesn't mean that the legislation would be finished by that time, that we would have our recommendations to the governor and to the legislature, but legislation would continue. And at that time, at the end of the legislative session, we will consider what to do next. We will have bills that will be coming forward.
Senator Nino.
I was just wondering, after February 1st, after the report is made available to the legislature, what would this task force be doing at that point? That's what I was wondering. What
until the end of this. Senator Rosen, what he's asking is, if the report is due February 1st, 2016, then why does the task force want to hang around until the last day of the 2016 legislative session?
Because we like to work. Senator Nino, I just think to marshal through the legislation and make sure that we have a succinct voice on the legislation that has to continue on. We have a tremendous amount of recommendations that will have to be gone through, what is doable, the money that needs to be appropriated. So there's a lot of work that will continue on after the report.
And may I add, Senator Rosen, there's many elements that we never got to in the task force in the child protection system, or when you move out of the child protection into the court system, you know, guardian ad litem, all sorts of things that are not yet even on the table for discussion. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to point out that next year we might not even be in session by February 1st, so we wouldn't have had the heart-to-hearts on a lot of that legislation. But Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, I've only seen a bit of the work that you've done, and it seems like very arduous and difficult work, and I appreciate your willingness to continue in that capacity. I have made the pitch to both of you about the foster care system. I think post-adoption should be on the list as well, and just add my voice that the work should continue.
Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Benson, Senator Nino. I mean, and when you start talking about the older children, when you start talking about the racial equity, there's a lot of issues that we have not been able to address, and so
you know, Senator Rosen, I'm just following up on Senator Benson's had mentioned earlier in the session concerns about the foster care system. We've all had various complaints, but Senator Benson in particular asked the question about whether or not there needed to be a specific task force related to foster care. And I was waiting to see where we were going to go with a variety of recommendations. But is there anything in here, or is there anything we might add to this that allows for this legislative task force to develop subcommittees that will deal? Because Senator Benson's right, these are, you know, just the foster care system is a huge subject and a huge complex system. So is there anything in here that would disallow us from saying we're going to have a subcommittee to this task force that's going to focus on maybe just foster care, and then another one that just is going to deal with this, and then we can bring it all together at the end, because it is an enormous, enormous task for four people, even with additional members.
Madam Chair, thank you. And I did have that conversation with Senator Benson at least a month ago, too. She asked if there was a possibility of putting something like this, like her initiative, on this bill. I was thinking of keeping it clean so we could just get it passed, no conference committee. I'm open to something else, but I do have some language being crafted right now for a foster care task force.
From this?
Yes, separate. But absolutely open, because it's a huge issue, and we're just scratching the surface on this issue
Give me a moment, I just wanted to look and see. Oh, you don't want to go to conference committee? Is that what you're saying? Let me just look at this language just for a second to see if we can't, by the way you've described it, establish a subcommittee on foster care, which would be a way of getting at what Senator Benson is recommending.
Subcommittee would be fine.
Madam Chair, wouldn't
Senator Wicklund?
Wouldn't number two expand the efforts into related areas?
Madam
Chair,
and it doesn't say we can't do it. So.
Developing a subcommittee.
Yes, Senator Benson.
Matters of legislative convenience. I think we've had the public discussion and message sent, message received. I don't think we want to muck up the legislation.
No, we don't. Madam Chair, Senator Benson, I'm not opposed to it. I just.
I think that Senator Wicklund was making a point that it looks like it is provided in the language under number two that we could do that should we choose to do that rather than have another piece of legislation on a task force. But we can continue that conversation about that.
And Madam Chair, I know Senator Benson is looking for other vehicles for something like that, which we always appreciate to keep it in the forefront and make sure that we take care of that issue.
Great. Okay. Any further discussion on the bill? Senator Rosen, your motion?
Thank you. Madam Chair, I recommend that Senate File 1876, as amended, be recommended, passed, and this one sent to the floor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Passes.
Thank you very much. Senator. Thank you, members. Thank you for the pizza, Madam Chair.
We are adjourned. When is our next meeting? We'll see you all bright and early, 8 a.m. tomorrow morning.
Oh, that's right.
Room 112.
8 o'clock? Thursday morning? 8?
Tomorrow morning.
I have 8:30 taxes.